Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskans.
Welcome to Chinook. I'm Paula Schiller. Inupiaq is one of the most used of the Alaskan native languages, spoken from Unalakleet to Bidar Island and on across Canada to Greenland. Edna McLean of the Alaska Native Language Center is working on an Inupiaq dictionary. She described the book and the process to Karen McPherson.
The purpose of this dictionary will be to have it complete form with the Inupiaq entry and the English definition so that the bilingual teachers in the Inupiaq areas can use it to get their vocabulary from when they're making out their lesson plans for language teaching.
Is it only Inupiaq English then, or is it also English Inupiaq?
Well, the bulk of the book will be from Inupiaq into English, mm-hmm. Okay? And then there'll be an index of English with Inupiaq words. There'll be a word like fish, okay, in the index. And then there'll be a list of words for fish in Inupiaq, depending on, you know, if it's a white fish or if it's a she fish. But their names will be there with no distinction in English. Okay, so person wanting to use the dictionary and that person speaking only English can go to the index, but he'd have to look up each word in Inupiaq to find whether that's the word that he really wants to use for that particular fish.
Okay, would there, in a regular, say, English mm-hmm. dictionary, mm-hmm. you look up a word and it gives the definition of that word.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is not that kind of dictionary. We're not looking up, we're not saying, okay, I only speak Inupiaq. I'd like mm-hmm. to find the definition of Ivic or something. And we'll look it up, and it's going to tell me in Inupiaq.
Okay, what I was just saying was in reference to the index. There'll be an English into Inupiaq index, okay? But the bulk of the dictionary is going to be in Inupiaq into English, where you look up an Inupiaq word, like the word for Ivic, you just said, and there'll be a definition of it in there, like walrus.
Okay, but in English. Okay.
But in English. So it's not a Inupiaq to Inupiaq dictionary.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And the purpose of this is so that our students can use it. We're not running away from reality when by saying that our students will be able to use it if we write it in Inupiaq to Inupiaq. That'd be perfect for a fluent speaker of Inupiaq.
You see that happening?
Or the older people. Or in my case, when I'm having a difficult time translating from the entry word that we have in Inupiaq and putting it into the English language, then I write the definition down in Inupiaq first. And then I get the essence of what the Inupiaq definition is and put it into English.
Do you find problems in that languages aren't equivalent, taking an Inupiaq word and trying to explain it in English?
Oh, yes. We have a lot of problems. That's why Marie Kazak is here working with me, and also I have other women in there like Martha Aiken and Emma Botfish. If I run across an Inupiaq word and write the definition down, then it comes to Marie, and if Marie and I can't figure it out together, then we call some person like Martha Aiken up in Barrow and finally decide on the definition.
Are there any words that have given you a particular problem?
There have been some words that we've run across in Inupiaq that we've had difficulty explaining in English. Like, for instance, the first word in the dictionary is Aruk, and the entry that we have in the dictionary is AA- dash. and we're trying to get the definition or the meaning of just that stem. And it took us quite a while. This definition has gone through several people, like someone here at the center wrote the definition down, then we sent the card up to Barrow, along with a lot of cards. We sent the cards up to Barrow to be verified and to be checked. And then they then the cards are sent back to ANLC. And then we put the definitions together, the definition that, like the way I understand it to be, or like Leona Okakok understood it to be at the time that she was working with us. So, but this particular word we had problems with, and it means to cry violently, becoming physically rigid, followed by temporary unconsciousness due to interrupted breathing. And that action is usually of a baby. Okay. Mm-hmm. So he's having a temper tantrum. You'll notice that when we first started working with this word, the definition meant to have a temper tantrum. Okay. But it didn't capture all of this other activity where the child would lose consciousness and just lay still on the floor. And then when that happened for too long, then the mother would pick up the child and start shaking it, or to have the baby start breathing again. But it was an action that we really couldn't use the English language, you know, with one word, temper tantrum, mm-hmm. to describe.
So it's a whole other way of conceptualizing that you're trying to deal with in this dictionary.
Oh, yes, uh-huh. And having English as a language to explain Inupiaq has proven to be difficult at times, but we're getting around it. We're getting better at using English, in twisting English, you might say, at times, but within the confines of the English language to explain Inupiaq.
Are there certain things about the Inupiaq language that make it such that it is, that creates that problem?
Oh, yes. The one portion of the dictionary is going to be on what we call demonstratives. And these words are very special in the Eskimo language because they're used to point, they're location words as well as identifiers, you know. In like in English, you have the words this and that to identify an object in space, in a certain position. When you say this, it's close to you, or that may be away from the speaker but closer to the English. Mm-hmm. Okay, or away from both of you. In Inupiaq, we have 22 stems, which make it up to about over 500 demonstratives that we have for objects in space. And since you have only two words to explain those things in English, then we have to make the definitions quite long. And one example of this is a word like kanna. Okay. When you say kanna, then the person conceptualizes something that is below the speaker and the listener. And it may be in a container, but you can see it. And it's not moving. Okay. So, and in contrast to that would be the word samna. When you use samna, then you're referring to an object which is also below you, but you can't see it, and you don't know whether it's moving or being still. Mm-hmm. So we have over 500 of those words, and there's a singular word for it and a dual reference and also a plural reference. And those are the words that I'd like to concentrate on in teaching of Inupiaq, because that's the real difference between the two languages. And it's the area that is usually missed when the language arts programs are being made in different areas, because we have to start thinking of the Inupiaq language first and how it breaks down, and the students don't have to learn these long words all at once, but they can be broken apart. And we're using the dictionary to break the words apart. And I don't know whether we're going to run into a lot of opposition from people, but what we're doing in the Inupiaq dictionary is writing down as the entry the stem of the word. Like when you look at a Greenlandic dictionary, you'll notice that the whole word is in there along with the ending. So essentially what they have in the Greenlandic dictionary is a sentence, a complete sentence as the entry. Because Inupiaq language is unique in that the verb is also a simple sentence. Okay. But in the dictionary for Inupiaq in Alaska, we've concentrated on isolating the verbs. And since we're doing that, we've also had to work on isolating the what we call post spaces. Okay.
Can you explain that?
The post spaces are morphemes, or they're units that contain meaning. And they are not stems because you cannot attach an ending onto them and form a complete word in Inupiaq. You have to have a stem like the word that I just pointed out to you, like ah, to cry violently and become unconscious. You can add a post space onto this stem and come out aneaktok. Okay, the word, the post space in the word that I just said aneaktok is neak. Okay, what we're doing is breaking up the word into stems, post spaces, and endings, and the dictionary is going to reflect that. Okay, there's going to be the dictionary will have at least three sections. Okay, there'll be the stem section, taking a word like ah, or a stem like savak, which means to work. Another one like nire, to eat. And another one like kukula, which means to holler or to call. Okay, to these stems you can add post spaces. And so far I've isolated at least 400 basic post spaces.
So to look up something in this dictionary, what you have to do is, after you've heard a word, you have to say, ah, the first part of that was, then I heard, and then the last sound that I heard was, and look up all those three sections?
Yes, you have to. And it'll be impossible for a person who hasn't had Inupiaq grammar or who's not aware of how an Inupiaq word is put together to use the dictionary.
I personally cannot imagine sitting down and making a dictionary. It's just incomprehensible to me.
Sometimes we want to throw the whole thing away, but no, I shouldn't say that. But it's the, you have to make everything so precise and make sure that the definition that you're working on is going to satisfy majority of the people. And of course, while you're working on the dictionary, you'll run across a person who doesn't agree with you with one little point. I would say that has been the most difficult job, is to define the word in English and satisfy all of the speakers of Inupiaq. I don't think we're going to satisfy all of the speakers of Inupiaq on particular definitions, because we're using, we're coming at this dictionary from the North Slope point of view. And when this dictionary reaches in the Kobuk area and they want to use it there, they'll find that the bulk of the definition is true for the area, but there might be a particular little aspect of that word that they use that we don't use in Barrow.
What's the greatest satisfaction for you?
The greatest satisfaction for me has been to know that we can send this dictionary up to the schools and have the different regions use it. And right now, they have copies of the dictionary as it is, although we haven't published it. And they can refer to the dictionary and use it in the schools to get their vocabulary from, and also to know that they can show this to the students and say, this is the dictionary of the Inupiaq language that we are studying in school.
Edna McLean of the Alaska Native Language Center talking with Karen McPherson on this edition of Chinook, a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
The best storyteller is one who lets you live if the weather is bad and you are hungry. I'll talk about this more. One man I knew long ago, he told me stories. He watched animals. He heard about animals and talked about them. Out of the talk came something. Once he sat down with me and said, "This story has something about ice fishing in it. You should know this thing. Maybe it won't be easy to hear inside the story, but it's there. Too easy to find? You might think it was too easy to do." Well, then he told me the story. Sure enough, there was an important thing in it about ice fishing. I heard it and remembered it. Later, I asked myself, what if a wind blew all the other people away and I was alone? Could I catch fish under the ice just going by what I learned in that story and a little of what I saw done during ice fishing season? I said to myself, yes. Then I knew he told a good story. Also, it made me laugh.
Some thoughts of William Smith Smith, a Cree Indian writer. Catherine McNamara has also thought a great deal about stories, about what they mean to the people who tell them, and about why so many Native stories don't make anybody laugh or cry or do anything a good story should after they've been translated into English. Catherine's experience has been in the McGrath area as a poet in the schools and director of higher education with the Iditarod School District. She says that to appreciate a story, you have to understand more than just the words.
It seems that Native people all over the world always call themselves the people or the people of this place. And then there are gradations, you know, in persons who live further and further away from the place. There's always a very strong relationship between the people, the place where they live, and the language they speak. You know, the language is full of very specific words that go with that place, and they're not easily transportable the way our language is. Our language is a language of movers, you know, of not even nomads, because nomads move within boundaries, but of people who move on to the next place, frontier people. But one of the things that the storytelling does is tell you where you've come from and give you an idea where you're going, and not just in this place surrounding your village, but from your ancestors and on down through your children, and then out in all directions. Mm-hmm. And anyone who thinks that the interior is a vast trackless wilderness has never flown over it and see moose tracks in the snow and snow machine trails and cat trails, and has never lived in a village and seen how every place in that village has a story attached to it. Something has happened there. Every person has generations of stories attached to him because his mother and father and his grandparents and his aunties and uncles and so on all lived in that place or came into that place and made their place there. And how people hold together, it seems to me, is by stories. Well, that, I think, started to pose some interesting problems for anthropologists and linguists because when those folks first started traveling and deciding that stories were important to pay attention to, at first they probably had to take them down by dictation. And you'd have some fellow who was a master storyteller in his village, you know, telling a story a few words at a time. And if you think what it would be like to try to dictate, well, it's not a fair analogy, but it's one from our experience that might be appropriate to say, if you were reading bedtime stories to your kids and instead of being able to read them or tell them to your kids, what you did was make the kids take them down in longhand, you know, you'd find a great difference in how you told the story.
It might be considerably shorter also.
And how can a kid get big eyes when he has to pay attention to writing the words down, getting them on the line and so on? Well, then when you start to have audio tapes and so on, then it's a different process. And the anthropologist can try to become more invisible and can record stories where and when they happen. And they happen at specific times. You know, there are some stories that people have that are only told at certain times of the year. And there are certain times of the year that are better for telling old stories and certain times of the year when you know, you tell about what the next season's going to be. I kind of noticed there are a lot more hunting stories, you know, toward the end of the summer. And in the late spring, a lot more fishing stories because fishing was coming up.
Mm-hmm. One of the things you were talking about that we kind of lost track of was a relationship between language and the thought process and the way a story comes out. And also in your experience in the schools, you've come across examples where the language and the thought process just don't work mm-hmm. in English translation.
I'm indebted to some other people for learning a lot more about this. Here at the university, Ron and Susie Scollin and some other people, but especially them, have done a lot of work with Athabascan people, finding out about, I guess how I'd call it is structures of stories. And what they find out is, we know this in various sorts of ways. I mean, one of the things we learn in our own culture is how we tell stories. And we learn that from the time we were a kid. Once upon a time. Sure. The story begins, okay? And then there are things that happen, it develops, and then it ends. And they lived happily ever after. The most simple, available way of talking about a story is that way. But
beginning, middle, and end.
Sure. And writers have to deal with that all the time. And it's one of the things that's happened with the modern novel. People play around with lopping off the beginning and putting you right in the middle of the story, or making the ending ambiguous instead of rounding it off. All of that is a play with form, and the form has a lot to do with how we perceive our lives going, okay? I'm vastly oversimplifying there, and working it out is in some ways a lot more interesting than
talking
about.
Well, you're not, because everybody knows if something isn't right, it doesn't have the beginning, middle, and end, you feel awkward. Maybe that's the intention,
right.
But you still feel
you
that's
feel
not
awkward.
Right.
Right. And then thinking about why it is you feel awkward, you might remember back to when you were a kid, you know, and your parents read you stories, or you had a grandparent around who told you stories, possibly, you know, in a grandparent from the old country, or at least in the East where I grew up, that was true for a lot of people I knew. But the stories are always there, and so you learn how to tell them. When I was working as a poet in the schools, I didn't edit kids very much, but because I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know what was important. It also occurred to me that it seems like Western story forms, to be real general, or organized in three parts or multiples of mm-hmm. three parts. Beginning, middles, and ends is one way to talk about that. What Ron and Susie Scollin show in their work is that Athabascans tend to organize in groups of four, divided into two or multiplied.
And a story might have a beginning,
two middles, and an end, roughly speaking. Well, what happens a lot of time in schools is kids are assigned themes. You're supposed to write, for example, about, summer on the lake, you know, so a kid will write about going out in a boat and seeing a moose and stopping to have tea and then coming home. And the teacher looks at it and it seems kind of flat, you know. And the teacher will say, and this is, I've seen this happen. I've seen it happen at all levels. I've seen it happen here at the university. The teacher will say, well, this is very interesting, but you don't need this part. And we'll start editing and tell the student, you can organize it tighter, okay. And the student looks at it and thinks, but they've just cut a part out of it. This doesn't make any sense anymore. And there's no way for the student to tell the teacher is wrong. You know, who's going to take on a teacher? So what happens is the teacher has just cut off, you know, the left leg of the story, and the student has to limp home.
And trying to pound a three-part story, a three-part culture, into a four-part story, a four-part culture, and possibly...
Yeah. What happens is then... this is true for almost for everybody who, you know, every outsider to the family who goes in and tries to understand what's going on there. It's going to take a long time to learn the lingo, to learn what's important, to learn who the characters are, you know, what everything means.
Mm-hmm.
And teachers are almost always the visitors, at least up here they are. This is not to dump on teachers so much as to say Anybody who, it seems to me, who is working with kids or with students, it seems to me has an enormous obligation not just to propose to teach what it is the teacher knows, mm-hmm. but to learn what it is the kids know. It goes both ways.
Mm-hmm. You could also even, not just with kids, but you could also run into trouble with anthropologists coming in, recording a bunch of stories in 3 weeks, and they might just hit the 3 weeks they're talking about fishing and may think there's no other story except a fish story.
Well, the other thing that happens then is people go away stealing stuff. I mean, people, early collectors, so-called, didn't just walk away with house posts and totem poles, say, from Southeast, or basketware and fish hooks and beadwork from the interior and ivory from the coast. They walked away with stories, and then they published them under their own names. Not so much, because in our culture, see, the reward of collecting and writing down and getting things ready for the page and then publishing is it's highly valued, and you're rewarded for that. The effort of putting something on the page is considered worthy of praise, and so people's names get attached to it. But story making is a very high art, and a fine storyteller is dealing with the material of all his people, but he's also putting his own heart and soul into it, his own knowledge and high skill, and that combination is not to be lightly disregarded. It seems to me that if you're going to do something like that, you have the obligation of not stealing other people's material, but of giving the proper credit. That's something that that a lot of writers too don't seem to realize, that you can't just go in, you know, and think you're talking about the country when you start talking about ravens and berry picking and all that stuff. You're not.
You're talking about people's lives and families, their ancestors and their private feelings about themselves and the places where they live. At least that's what more and more story collectors are becoming aware of. Talking about stories was Catherine McNamara of the Iditarod School District. I'm Paula Schiller, and you've been listening to Chinook, a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.